Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Mustn't Say Hitler. Tonight, we're joined by Boris Johnson, Ken Livingstone, David Cameron and Nigel Farage. Round one over to you, Boris. What is the square root of 678?
Hitler.
I'm afraid not. You're out already. Over to you, Ken. What country's capital is Bogota?
Hitler.
No, I'm afraid not. Sorry, Ken. Next one's for you, David.
Hitler. Hitler. Hitler.
No, please stop it, Boris and Kent. Your round is up. Over to you, David Cameron. A marmoset is from which mammalian family?
Hitler.
Incorrect. And last question to you, Nigel Farage. What is the name of the infamous World War II German dictator?
This European Union is the new communism.
Well, that's actually a bit of a surprise.
Was I ever a member of any extremist political group? No, I was a member of the Conservative Party.
Yeah, same thing, isn't it? Well, once again, not only have you all lost, but so have the public. Tune in next time to I'm an MP and I mustn't say...
Hitler.
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 Hello, and welcome to Partly Political Hitler. Sorry, broadcast. Partly Political Broadcast, episode 17. I'm Hitler. I'm Tiernan Duyeb. And on this week's show, there is an interview with Hitler, some stuff about Hitler, and Hitler. Oh God, I'm so sorry. I'm just practicing in case I ever decide to get into... being an ex-London mayor. What I meant to say was that on this week's show, there is an interview with Arik Chowdhury about why we don't yet have online voting. There is the dreaded return of with or without EU, and I'll be looking at why Labour are in such a mess. Yes, this is a 5-hour podcast. Ha! Joke! It is only 4 hours 59. Thanks, as always, for tuning in, especially to all the new listeners, thanks to a very nice endorsement from Frankie Boyle last week, which was very good to get. If you are new to the show, then welcome, and don't forget to let me know all your thoughts about it on our Twitter and Facebook at ParpolBro, or by reviewing it on iTunes, or by sending me an email on our completely unused email address, partlypoliticalbroadcast@gmail.com, which is unused. It seems to sit completely empty, apart from Tumblr telling me about all the things that I don't have time to look at. Not that we haven't had any emails to the show, of course, it's just that all you clever people seem to send them directly to my personal email address via my website, which I would have thought would be much harder to find on account of all my millions of vowels in my name. I mean, really, partlypoliticalbroadcast@gmail.com, that's a lot easier to spell than Tin and Duyeb, isn't it? I mean, are you just throwing vowels into Google and it's coming up with the goods? Who knows? Anyway, one such email that I did receive this week was from Matthew Barracliffe. Hello, Matthew. I am waving, but it's pointless because this is audio only and the people across the road look really unnerved. Matthew's email is very nice, but he says that he listens to the show in an urban area and with the volume up quite loud in order to be able to hear it despite all the road traffic. And that does mean, though, that he is hugely deafened by, and this is how he's brilliantly written it, the blah, 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 blah bit. I guess that is sort of how it sounds. And So, Matthew, I'm sorry that you're being deafened, but I will be honest. I was purposefully putting up that bit very loud in an attempt to deafen all the listeners before June so you wouldn't have to hear any more EU campaign bollocks. It was my attempt to save you people. But despite those attempts to save the people, I will instead save your ears, Matthew, and this week hopefully the blah, 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 blah bit should be a shade lower. How do I not know that tune? I hear it every week. Anyway, it should all be a bit better. I mean, it's only taken me 17 episodes to work out how sound levels work. So, progress, people, progress. Also, regular listeners may note I no longer have a croaky voice after I beat it into submission by talking until it lost interest and went away. Again, I am learning a lot from the EU referendum campaigns. Right, now here is a few
headlines.
The BBC charter renewal was unveiled last week, and like Saturday Kitchen when James Martin left, is nowhere near as bad as everyone thought it would be. On the other hand, much like the new series of Top Gear, everyone is wondering why it had to happen in the first place, and why isn't there anything in it to stop Chris Evans from ever having to be seen or heard by anyone ever again. The few notable bits in the charter are that the licence fee will continue for 11 years, all BBC employees earning over 450 grand a year will be named, even if they had names already, apparently, and the BBC Trust will be replaced with a panel partly appointed by the government, which means it definitely won't have anything to do with trust anymore. The BBC will now also be required to give greater focus on promoting diversity, which is a very good thing and I think long overdue. Although, judging by the diversity in Parliament, I worry that the small print in John Whittingzale's charter just suggests that the BBC have shows featuring old white men but in a variety of suits and maybe call it the Great British Bore Off. Natalie Bennett says she'll be stepping down as Green Party leader, or, as they say in the Green Party, she'll be making like a tree and leaf. No, I am not sorry. During Natalie Bennett's 4 years as leader, she saw membership of the party increase dramatically. The party increased its members of European Parliament quite highly as well. And Natalie Bennett also managed to do one of the worst interviews anyone has ever heard that she blamed on having a cold, even though you'd think that having a head full of green stuff would have actually helped her. There are no clues who's up for Green Party leader next. Recent mayoral candidate Sian Berry, who has the perfect surname for a Green Party candidate, says she won't be standing though. I wonder if maybe they'll just get Caroline Lucas back so that they can recycle an old one. Wales is in political limbo, which is sort of like normal limbo, only nobody's having fun and the bar starts pretty low in the first place. Both former First Minister Carwyn Jones and Plaid Cymru's Leanne Wood got 29 votes each from the Welsh Assembly to become First Minister. Labour members backed Carwyn. Meanwhile, Leanne received backing from the Conservatives and UKIP, despite Plaid Cymru previously saying that a Tory-UKIP deal was completely out of the question. It's almost like principles come second place to power or something. Weird, isn't it? It'd be a really odd combination for Wales as well to have a Plaid Cymru, UKIP and Conservative assembly, especially as Wales really have only previously had right-wingers on their rugby teams. The Conservatives now say that they're going to abstain from a second vote allowing Carwyn to win if it happens, and the assembly has until the 2nd of June to decide before they have to have another election. Meanwhile, who knows what the UKIP assembly members will do as they're run by Neil Hamilton, a man so awful that he puts other MPs off being disgraced as it'd mean they'd actually have to have something in common with him. Other UKIPers don't think Hamilton will unite the party, which is probably because he's only ever good at uniting money with his pocket and farce with everything he does. On May the 12th, David Cameron hosted an anti-corruption summit. Yes, I really said that. Yes, it really happened. Yes, it probably was a bit like Azalea Banks hosting a forum on building bridges and making friends. Just a couple of days before Cameron hosted it, he was caught by a camera microphone saying to the Queen that Nigeria and Afghanistan would be attending and are fantastically corrupt. The Queen was visibly shocked by this, probably because she realised she no longer owned either of those countries. Not only is fantastically corrupt the sort of language only a supervillain would use, you know, along with deliciously evil and curiously minty, but also Nigeria's civil society groups have actually asked old Dave only a few weeks ago to do something about all the dirty money from Nigeria that gets laundered in the UK. They complain that many UK authorities turn a complete blind eye to money hidden in our property market, car dealerships and private schools and all the sorts of places that use the clever tactic of disguising money with yet more money. Meanwhile, Afghanistan welcomed David Cameron's comments about them, saying that the country did used to have high corruption but is acting against it, and that really it would help an awful lot if the West, aka the UK and US, didn't keep the Afghanistan narcotic industry alive. Narcotics that I guess are probably mostly getting consumed in the property market, car dealerships and private schools, using some of the laundered Nigerian money to funnel it through their noses. The last time there was an anti-corruption summit, 3 years ago at the 2013 G8, three global policy proposals were made, none of which have been fully delivered by anyone that attended. Hooray! These three policies were to make country-by-country reporting public, for an automatic exchange of financial information, and to have globally available public registers of beneficial ownership. All sounds quite sensible. And this time round, well, still not much progress. Well, except in the area of public registers, right? Five countries signed up to have transparency of beneficial ownership of companies, trusts and foundations in the UK and its dependent territories. And those countries are France, Kenya, Netherlands, and, yeah, you've guessed it, the fantastically corrupt Afghanistan and Nigeria, doing something that will stop them being fantastically corrupt. And you know who completely failed to meet any of the standards set by the UK back in 2013? Yeah, that is right, the UK. Well done, us! It's like setting an example of how to drive safely by ploughing your car directly into a tree. So, as the Electoral Commission take the Conservative Party to the High Court for possibly breaching electoral spending conditions, you have to wonder if Cameron meant fantastically corrupt as a compliment, hoping that one day, under him, he'd help the UK get to the same sort of standards. All I can say is, good luck, Azalea. There's hope for you. The turnouts for the UK elections last week ranged from between 20% to somewhere under 50%, with Scotland getting slightly higher. The news suggested that this was a good result, which made me really feel that if that was true, I should have got a much better degree at university. It seems to be a consistent problem with UK elections that the majority of people can't be bothered to vote, even though the results directly affect their lives. And I guess part of this might be to do with having a phobia of tiny pencils attached by tiny bits of string, but it could also be due to the inconvenience of it all. A few of my Twitter followers told me that in the recent elections, their polling stations didn't have disabled access, and voters in Barnet were turned away due to missing names on their voter lists and then weren't able to return later on. And then there's also the hours and the locations, and you start to wonder why we can't just vote online in today's day and age. I mean, you can do everything else online nowadays, you know, from paying your taxes to checking how depressing your bank balance is now that you've paid your taxes, to booking a doctor's appointment because of how sick you feel from checking your bank balance. So why can't you just open up your phone, pop a smiley face by your favourite candidate, and, you know, maybe a smiling poo by the one that you dislike, and cast a vote that way? I mean, when the robots take over, it'll be the only way to vote anyway, so why not get a head start on the T-1000s? This week, I spoke to Arik Chowdhury from Webroots Democracy, a campaign for online voting and tackling growing political apathy. We had a lovely chat, and he definitely swayed me to give online voting my online vote. Okay, hi Arik. So voter turnout across the UK last week on May the 5th was between 20 and 45% roughly, and I think Scotland had a bit of a higher turnout. Why is it that a lot of the media is saying that that's a high turnout or it's a good turnout when it's less than half of the voting electorate?
Well, I think the turnout is probably higher because of the low barrier that's already been set. So for example, in a lot of these police and crime commissioner elections, the average turnout previously was around 15 to 20%. And in elections in Wales, for example, was around 40%. And Scotland, interestingly, although it did go up to 55%, that's only 4 percentage points higher than the previous Scottish Parliament election, which was before the referendum. So I think it was expected that it would actually be a lot higher post-referendum because of the mass amount of voter engagement we saw during that period. However, it doesn't seem to have had a massive impact on the Scottish Parliament elections. Although, like you said, you know, most of these elections are lower than 50%, which frankly isn't good enough at all in any type of democracy where really it should be the majority of people having a say on the direction of their future.
I mean, do you think people just didn't care about these ones much? Because, I mean, I know, to be honest, the Police and Crime Commissioner, I knew nothing about. I never do. I don't really know why I should vote on it. You know, there are, I wonder if there's that sort of feeling towards the recent
ones. I agree. I think devolution is a good thing. However, you need to really explain it to people, what it is, and then market these elections to the same extent that you market the general election. So see, a lot more money is spent on the general election when we're electing MPs to Parliament, whereas you can argue local councillors do equally important jobs. It's just on another, it's on a different level in terms of your local services and social care, for example. And also the Scottish Parliament and the Welsh Assembly are very important elections in Wales and Scotland, although you don't see the same sort of attention given to it by central government, which I think there should be. But I do agree that some people, if they don't know much about it, then they're much less likely to probably go out and vote in those elections.
And do you think, do you think that the apathy towards politics is still a problem overall? Because, I mean, obviously you say that these numbers are a higher turnout than the last time. So does that mean less people are apathetic than before? Or is it still a wide problem that that people don't really care?
I guess the difficulty is that with these elections, because they're every 4 years or so, the people we're comparing it to are different. So the same people who were apathetic last time could still be apathetic this time, even though turnout has changed. But I do think apathy is a big problem. I mean, there are quite a few studies which have shown around 20% of people just wouldn't vote regardless, I think, of what the issues are or who's standing or things like that. I do think there needs to be... Although, I guess, in my opinion, I actually don't believe anyone's truly apathetic, in terms that once you explain to people what these elections are actually about, you'll realise that they do care. So if you say to people, oh, your police and crime commissioners decide, you know, how policing is run in your area, do you care about policing in your area? Everyone would say yes, you would imagine.
Mm.
So a lot of it is about communication and actually engaging people with those issues, which I don't think enough of is done in that respect. Although, like I said, there are a lot of people who just probably wouldn't vote regardless because of cynicism and things like that.
And is it still a big problem amongst young people? Because I remember that being the case sort of coming up to the 2015 general election. But then since then, there's been a lot of reports how a lot of young people have been joining political parties. So is it still, do you think apathy is still high amongst sort of people under 30, under 25?
Yeah, so in the, I think in the Labour Party, they've found that the average age of their membership has gone down. So it's younger, which is an indication of more young people getting involved in political parties. However, in the general elections of the past four general elections, the voter turnout amongst young people aged 18 to 25 has been below 50% in each of those. And that's compared to, let's say, those aged over 65, where you're seeing turnouts of 70 to 75%. So it's quite a big gap. And I think there is particularly a case of young people not being engaged in politics, and that could be, you know, a number of reasons. But one of the reasons I think is quite important is that politics simply doesn't reflect the lives of young people. There's quite a big disconnect in that respect.
But isn't that what I've heard people say before is that, you know, young people don't vote, therefore politicians feel no need to try and pander to young people's needs.
Politicians, because of the nature of their jobs being up for grabs every 5 years, they will mainly focus on people who vote for them. And like you said, you know, if young people don't vote, there's a lot less incentive for politicians to go out and canvass for their votes, because in their eyes, it may not have as much currency as someone who's aged over 65 or whatever age or whatever demographic who will regularly go out and vote. So, you know, if you do get more young people voting, then you are more likely to get politicians who will cater more to their needs.
So it's a bit of a catch-22 situation, isn't it, really? Yeah. If they want them to care more, they need to go out and vote. But if you want them to go out and vote...
I think the onus is on the politicians to engage people rather than the people to engage as much with their politicians, because politicians are there to represent, and as part of representing, you have to engage with people.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And do you think, because there's been a lot of, I've read quite a lot about how they feel this sort of recent electoral reform kind of knocked a lot of people off the electoral register. And particularly it seems to have affected a lot of young people, a lot of private renters. And, yeah. do you think that's probably added to the voter turnout numbers this time round?
It's hard to tell what impact it's had on the voter turnout, but you can tell that there are areas that they really should have done it differently. I mean, the idea of having individual electoral registration is a good thing in terms of getting around people perhaps committing voter fraud in certain areas or people not even realising that they're registered. However, when you look at young people, for example, at university or in halls of residence, the previous way of voter registration was so much more efficient and so much more and ensured that everyone was registered. So it's a university, I think, halls of accommodations that would register just everyone in their halls to be able to vote in the next election, whereas now you're asking hundreds of people to do it individually. In my opinion, obviously people will fall off their register because not everyone will register to vote. So I think really a better idea would simply be doing something like a checkbox when you sign up for a GP, like, do you also want to be registered to vote in this area or something like that. I don't think it should really necessarily have to be its own separate form or separate thing for someone to do to register. So I do think that perhaps is something that has meant less young people are registered to vote. Although I do think the move to registering to vote online has had a very good impact. So I think before the general election, on the final day of the registration deadline, something like 400,000 people registered to vote on that final day, which I don't think we've seen in the previous just paper only system.
Yeah. Because I suppose people can leave it right till the deadline.
Yeah.
And then just go online. I mean, and I know that's something obviously that you sort of champion doing is having online voting as well. And I mean, I have to say, it sort of strikes me as amazing that we don't have that, considering everything else we can do online in today's, that, I can bank online and make GP appointments and everything else. I mean, what, obviously you think online voting would make a massive difference. And do you think that's just because we're now in a technological age where everyone's so used to, what differences would it make if we could all just click?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, like you said, we do live in a different culture, I would say, today than we did maybe 30, 40 years ago. When we look at the way that we do everything online, I mean, in terms of banking, shopping, socialising, communicating with friends and family, all of this we do online. Even education, a lot of it is moving online, and that is because of the benefits it has in terms of reaching out to more people, it being a more efficient way of doing things, and frankly a better way in many respects of doing things. In terms of online voting, I do think it would increase voter turnout in terms of, if you look at most of the things that have moved online in this country, you've seen greater engagement with those services. And also, accessibility is a big thing when it comes to elections. Like you said previously, there's so many elections now and people don't have that much time to necessarily keep in touch with all these things or maybe understand what they're all about. So what one thing online voting could do is really be a more informative way of voting. So let's say there was a central voting website, you can literally go on there, find out what your local councillor does before you vote, or even find out who they are and what they stand for before you vote. Whereas when you go to a polling station, you're just frankly just faced with a ballot paper and a faceless individual on that paper. And in terms of accessibility, there are a lot of people currently who are locked out of the voting process altogether. So if you're someone with a vision impairment or a disability, it's very, very difficult to cast an independent vote, and sometimes impossible, especially if you're blind. You'll have to rely on someone else to cast that vote on your behalf, even a postal vote in that respect. And if you have a disability, again, it's very inaccessible to be able to vote by post or at a polling station. So a lot of the groups who are calling for online voting are disability organisations as well.
Yeah, because I had a few people sort of message me on Twitter the other day on voting day, saying that their polling station had no disabled access at all, which is crazy.
It's outrageous. I mean, if you look at the the Barnet in London, Barnet Council, seemed to have messed up their vote on the dais, and they had the wrong voter register, so they didn't have people coming up to the polling station unable to vote because their name wasn't on the register. And a lot of those people said they weren't able to vote on that day because the only time they could vote was in the morning, or they had other priorities throughout their day, or going abroad and stuff like that. And again, we did have an online voting system. How much more accessible would that be? You wouldn't even need to go at 7 a.m. in the morning. You could just literally vote throughout the day, or if they messed it up during the day, you could just vote on your smartphone later on. I mean, there are a lot of benefits to online voting. I mean, not just accessibility, but also the cost of elections in the long run could go down with an online voting system.
Yeah, because you'd need less staff, I guess, and you wouldn't need so much paper or pencils or any of that kind of
thing. Yeah, and when you integrate, if you were to integrate an online voting system with social media, for example, that sort of effects on engagement would be huge in terms of, you know, engaging young people, for example. I mean, if you look on Facebook, and I think Facebook this year had a button on it which says something like polling day is today. And imagine if you had something like that, but it linked to an online voting website. I mean, you could see a lot of young people, but also, you know, people from all sorts of ages, becoming more engaged with elections, which I think is crucial. I mean, it's simply not good enough to have people voted in consistently on turnouts of less than 50%, or in some cases 10%. It's not democratic. I mean, we live in a democracy, but, you know, it could be a lot more democratic. I mean, lower than 50%, in my opinion, is scraping the barrel, to be honest.
Yeah, well, it's now sort of trade unions have to have over that in order to have a strike, you know, have a strike, and yet we can have a government.
Basically, quite against the idea of having a threshold. So, like you were saying about the trade unions having a 50% threshold voter turnout, I used to be quite against it, but now I actually think it might be quite a good idea. I mean, it would force a lot of politicians to take voter reform seriously, I think, if it meant that they weren't being able to be elected unless they could get a 50% turnout.
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe it's an idea that we should have.
We'll return to Arik in a minute, but first, and yeah, look, I'm really sorry about this, but it is...
With or without you, with or without you.
Yes, it's back. No, no one sent me a better jingle for it. No, I'm also still not sorry. Both EU referendum campaigns have stepped up the pace now that the local elections are over, and the bullshit flow.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Gates have opened, suffocating almost all other political news. Some of my favourite worst things that people have been saying have been Gordon Brown saying that leaving the EU wouldn't be very British. I mean, that is just a weak soundbite, isn't it? Although I suppose he is right. I mean, really, the British thing would be to stay with the EU and completely suffer, even if you hate it, spending all the rest of your days telling everyone how unhappy you are, but doing nothing about it. Also, Ian Duncan Smith said that the EU is a force for social injustice. Yes, that Ian Duncan Smith, the one that was a force for social injustice. That Ian Duncan Smith who championed non-paying workfare, who's now saying that if we leave the EU, workers' wages would go up. Yeah, he actually said those things. He also said how the EU harms people who are worse off. And you sort of wonder if this is all just part of a speech in order to make pots and kettles resign everywhere. As well as Ian Duncan Smith and Gordon Brown, other commentators in the past week included the International Monetary Fund. They said that a Brexit would be bad to very, very bad for the UK, a situation that's so dire it sounds like if we leave, we'll lose vocabulary and descriptive terms as well. David Cameron said that a Brexit could endanger peace, seemingly forgetting entirely about NATO and the UN, although I suppose if we do Brexit, the crowing about winning that we'll hear from the Leave camp for years and years to come will definitely infringe on any attempts of peace and quiet the rest of the country tries to have. Several of the very stupid papers have said that the EU is now aiming to ban British kettles, toasters and hairdryers after the referendum because nothing motivates people like the prospect of wet hair and no breakfast. This is all, as you'd expect, complete and utter nonsense. Surprise! And actually all part of the European Commission eco-design scheme, which just aims to make products more efficient and environmentally friendly. There's 29 products that they're currently reviewing, and out of those, when it comes to kettles, they're reviewing them to make them more durable, you know, and last longer. So it's better to buy them. They'll keep for a while. And with their hairdryers, they're currently reviewing them to make sure that the wattage used is equal to the performance. So your hairdryer could have high wattage if it dries your hair quicker because of it. Essentially, the Daily Mail and the Express just seem to be scared that the EU will stop them wasting a lot of hot air with no results, which I guess considering their usual output would probably put them out of business. And of course, Boris Johnson compared the EU to Hitler because that is part of the clause for being an ex-mayor of London, apparently. I mean, I'm sure as soon as Sadiq retires, he'll be Hitler all over the shop. That's just how it goes. And let's face it, Boris's comparison of the EU to Hitler really works and makes sense, doesn't it? Because, I mean, I don't know if you know your history, but Hitler was all for a united trade union of countries who provided free movement to all people and was created to stop war between member states. Yeah, totes classic Hitler. And also, I tried to sit through Brexit the movie, which, yeah, actually exists. You can find it on the YouTubes. But I should warn you, because within 30 seconds of clicking play, it features both James Dellingpole and Melanie Phillips. And you realise that it is an hour of all the people you hate from Question Time, one after the other, which no one has ever asked for. And at no point do any of them blow up or get maimed, so it's completely pointless viewing. At one point, someone actually says, "I wouldn't profess to understand the detail of how the EU all works. I think some of that's deliberate." Brilliant. Well, I'm so glad you gave your views then, you idiot. Then there is a fisherman who says that the EU has ruined the fishing industry, seemingly ignoring that before EU policies came into play, fish stocks were in severe decline. And let me tell you, nothing would ruin the fishing industry more than, you know, a total and utter lack of fish. As a movie, Brexit the movie does indeed score very highly on imaginative fictional content. But it doesn't have any black or minority ethnic characters apart from one guy in the street that they ask a question to. It definitely doesn't pass the Bechdel test. And the only thing I can say that it really has going for it is that there are more dinosaurs throughout it than any single one of the Jurassic Park films. So, I thought I'd end this week's With or Without EU with a teeny bit of actual facts from a full fact piece I read earlier this week. Again, I know I bang on about it, but do check out fullfact.org. It really is great for, you know, actual information without any of the crap attached. So, here's the bit of a facts. Ian Duncan Smith has been saying that the EU is damaging to workers and people on lower pay. And David Cameron and Jeremy Corbyn are both saying that leaving the EU would be damaging to those people. So we're getting completely different arguments, essentially saying that will affect the same people whether we leave or go. So which one is actually correct? Well, here's the thing, with everything it's not at all clear cut and there's no definite answers. But firstly, in terms of workers' rights, the EU does give us quite a few of those, which is handy. Under EU working policies are things like the Working Time Directive, which guarantees the right to time off and limited working hours. Then there's also employment rights for parental leave, equal opportunities for men and women, and protection of employment upon transfer of business. There were various UK policies in place already, and, you know, things like the minimum wage are UK law and not EU law, so we would keep that. But you do sort of have to wonder if a government that's currently forcing through the trade union bill, has brought in workfare and unpaid apprenticeships, wanted to change Sunday trading hours, thinks junior doctors can work insanely long hours with no consequence, and wants everybody to work until they're 70, you know, would they really bring in their own policies to cover the missing EU ones if we left? Similarly, the Remain campaign has said that a lot of jobs will be lost if we leave the EU, but the Centre for Economic and Business Research says that about 3.1 million jobs are linked to exports with the EU. And that's not membership, that is just exports. So there is absolutely no way of knowing if any of these would be automatically lost if we did have a Brexit vote. At the same time, all of those jobs do depend on exporting things to countries in the EU, so that could all become a bit more tricky and therefore, I suppose, could make the jobs disappear. But once again, there is no easy answer, proving that both campaigns are talking absolute bullshit. On the plus side, I guess, if we do leave and 3.1 million people do in fact lose their jobs, then I guess they won't have to worry about the government getting rid of all their annual leave. Every cloud, eh? Every cloud. Now, back to Arik. And so what are the, because I mean, everything you've just said sounds so incredibly sensible and useful. And I mean, I love the idea that you could be about to vote for someone and then click on the info button and read about them and go, oh no, actually no, I'm going to vote for someone else. You know, it'd be so useful to have that kind of information. Why isn't this being put in place? What are the barriers? What's stopping the Electoral Commission doing this?
So I think the main barrier, I think, is the same as the main barrier to every type of electoral reform, which is that politicians may not see the incentive to change a system that's already electing them in. So when it comes to things like, for example, proportional representation, a lot of people think that makes sense, but politicians are unlikely to change a system that regularly brings them into power. So I think political will is a big barrier to getting online voting in, because again, that's another big voter reform. Let's say you're seeing millions of more people voting, that could change the result of an election, really. But again, the second main barrier I would say is security. The government or members of the public may be worried about the security of an online voting system. How can we trust it? How can we know that the person you voted for is the vote that is counted? Or what do we do if the system is hacked? Things like that, which I would say is a big concern. And then the third main barrier is the initial financial cost of implementing this system. So the government responded recently to one of our reports and said that they see the cost as quite a big barrier in terms of austerity, for example. Although arguments in terms of security, I think, are being won, and political will, I think, is a matter of time.
Because, I mean, I'm guessing that's the sort of other thing that I would think is that there are people that still don't have access to the internet in the UK, or good broadband speed or 3G or whatever. And I guess there are also, there's a terrible generalisation, but older people that don't use the internet very often. So would you still need the original polling stations and online voting at the same time, which then I guess would be quite costly?
That's the process that I'm advocating. I'm only advocating online voting as an option. I think we should keep, if people want to vote at polling stations, they should be able to vote at polling stations. If people want to be able to vote by post, they should be able to vote by post. And I think if people want to be able to vote online, they should be able to vote online. So I would be in favour of keeping all three of those. And I think having all three of those actually improves the system in terms of security. So, for example, one country that uses online voting is Estonia. And in Estonia, they've actually integrated the polling station and online voting methods together, in that, so with their system of online voting, they have something called repeat voting, where you can vote multiple times over an extended period in an election with only your last vote counting. And that's the sort of guard against people.
Quack, 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 quack. Hello, right. Sorry, lost you then. That might have been my end, sorry.
Sorry.
That's cool. It's all recording again. You were just telling me about Estonia and their voting system. Okay. If you wouldn't mind starting that from the beginning, that would be brilliant. Thank you.
So, from which part, sorry? Do you want to start just Estonia?
Well, I had it all the way up to you telling me about Estonia's voting. So if you want to start from what they have in Estonia, that would be great. Thank you.
Okay, cool. So in Estonia, which is one country that does have online voting in elections, they've integrated their polling stations votes with their online voting method. And that's to sort of improve the process of voting there. So in Estonia, they have something called repeat voting, which is where you can vote multiple times over an extended period with only your last vote counting. And that's to guard against things like being pressured to vote a certain way, or someone buying your vote, or someone, you know, maybe stealing your vote, for example. And if your last vote in that system is tampered with in any way, you can then vote in a polling station, which then discounts any online vote that's done. So that adds a sort of extra safeguard to their voting system, which you don't have with just a polling station or just a postal vote. Once those votes are tampered with, it's very difficult to change your vote after that. So I would only advocate it as an option alongside polling station and postal voting. And I think that works a lot better rather than just having purely one method of voting.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. I mean, Estonia, I've done shows over there, and they're incredibly technologically just on the case, you know.
Yeah.
They have a phrase called an Estonian party, and that's when everyone in a room is just on their phones, not talking to each other, which is brilliant. Yeah. So I mean, I suppose, and I should say that I think the idea of online voting is brilliant, everything you've said sounds incredibly reasonable. I suppose my only concern would be that looking at Barnet the other day, that was their new computerised system that messed up their register and all the different names, and I suppose if we had anyone other than this government in charge of it, I trust a computerised voting system. Is there worries that, you know, that we implemented wrongly, or it'd be given to the wrong contract? How can we guarantee that it'll be a decent working system?
Yeah, I should have said one of the other barriers is that people don't trust the government with technology. So it is a difficulty. I mean, you have to get a proper process in. You have to get proper tendering process, proper checks and balances over these systems. However, you know, even if it's a paper method of voting, there are still problems. So if you have a look at, I don't know if you've ever been to a vote count before, but a paper vote count.
No.
So I've been to one before, and what you have there is a lot of miscounting of votes and a lot of recounts of votes, especially when it's a close margin, which kind of shows that there's no guarantee that every vote actually counts under the current system if people are counting them inaccurately. And I think that's quite important. I mean, you know, every vote should count. If someone's gone to a polling station and they voted, their vote should count towards their election of their representative. And, you know, there are lots of examples of where non-electronic services have gone wrong. So it is all about doing these things properly. But if there is a problem, like I was saying earlier, if there is a problem with an online voting system on the day, people can still vote later on in that day once it's been fixed. So, you know, the accessibility is still there in terms of you don't have to go back to the polling station to vote. You can literally just wait a few hours and then vote on your smartphone later. It's not too big of an issue if something does go wrong. Although I do agree, you know, if they do this, it has to be done properly. And if there are any problems, the person who should be paying for that is whoever is providing that technology or working on that contract, not the taxpayer.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that is just, like I said, that is just my fear that it will get, I don't know, given to G4S or something, and half of it won't work. But yeah, it's also a very good point. If it does go wrong, you can just say, oh, right, well, then we'll do it tomorrow instead. Everyone open their phones, click, and it's already done. It sounds so incredibly sensible. Last question really then, if people would like to kind of get involved with this and they'd like to petition towards online voting, and really also to tackle voter apathy, what sort of stuff would you suggest they do? Where can they go? What can they get involved with?
So if they want to get involved with Webroots, I would say to follow us on social media at Webroots UK. And on there, you'll find our petition that we're doing to the government. We're trying to reach the 10,000 signature threshold to get a response within 6 months. So you can sign that. And also, if you visit our website, webroots.org, there are lots of ways you can get involved. But in terms of tackling voter apathy in general, you know, I would say talk about politics with your friends. I think it's a very good way of getting people interested. So I think, you know, maybe not enough people are having conversations about this kind of thing. And also, you know, just to get involved with a political party, get involved with a political campaign, because, you know, I don't believe that anyone's truly apathetic about politics. There's always something, some issue that people care about. And if there is an issue that you care about, you should just get involved and try to change it. I mean, that's basically what I'm trying to do here with online voting. And I think that's probably the best method of tackling voter apathy in the long run, is just literally getting more people involved in politics.
Many thanks to Arik for chatting with me. You can find Webroots Democracy at webrootsdemocracy.org. And if you click on their Get Involved section, you'll find a link to the e-petition for online voting, which sounds appropriate, doesn't it, really? They're also on Twitter at WebrootsUK, and Arik has his own account at Arik Chowdhury. So that's AreekChowdhury. So go and follow him and do all of those things. Thank you all. The name Labour used to mean all about supporting the workers. But now it seems to apply much more about how much bloody hard work it is for anyone in the party to agree on absolutely anything. A week doesn't go by without someone from Labour attacking someone else from Labour, as though they're going into battle blindfolded, and at the last minute a Tory MP spins them round 180 degrees. If Labour are still a party, it's one where half of them won't invite the others along because they think they'll ruin it, and the other side have their own gathering in a treehouse with a big sign on the door saying no Corbyn's allowed. Those in the party who dislike Corbyn took the recent election results to mean that he'd failed, even when the party did better than it was predicted to. Wes Streeting, who is the Labour Party barnacle, in that I mean that no one really wants him there, he's irritating everyone by being attached, but just won't leave of his own accord. Well, Wes, he blamed the Havering and Redbridge London Assembly loss on Labour's anti-Semitism row. Though in Havering and Redbridge, UKIP support rose really quite highly, and I don't really think that all those previously Labour voters thought, do you know what, I'm sick of this anti-Semitism, I'm going to go to UKIP. Unless, I suppose, they were looking for a party who are actually better at being racist all-rounders. Who knows? Chris Leslie said on the BBC that Labour need to move more centre to appeal to voters, which isn't at all what they did in 2015, is it, Chris? And that turned out really well, eh? Do you remember? Oh. And since he's become Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan has been making lots of public statements aimed towards Jeremy Corbyn along the lines of, we can't ignore what voters want, which is one of those ridiculously obvious statements that carries the same sort of weight as when Bitty McLean sang, when it's raining, it's raining. But at the same time, those on Jeremy Corbyn's side have always got an excuse for when the party isn't doing well. MP Diane Abbott, whose main skill appears to be having the power to sound patronising even when she's making absolutely no sense. She said that the results show that Corbyn is on his way to a 2020 victory at the general election. Except they don't. And really, after a few months where the Conservatives have somehow managed to piss off doctors and teachers, their Secretary of Work and Pensions resigned over proposed welfare cuts that he probably would have inflicted himself just months later if he'd stayed, there was the Panama Papers, the budget, tons of U-turns, and all the infighting over the EU referendum, you sort of think, really, Labour could have cleaned this up quicker than Harvey Keitel using Sillit Bang. But they didn't. And subscribing to this new politics that Labour are doing is really great, you know, except when it means that you look really confused during Prime Minister's questions instead of slamming Cameron for being a racist pillock and watching as his face looks like it might erupt like an upset balloon. And yeah, look, I think those from within Labour shouldn't be trying to tear it apart, but then every time there are rumours about Corbyn clamping down on disloyalty, I also remember that he voted against the party from the backbenches many, many times. And I should say that I like Jeremy Corbyn. I sort of think he looks a bit like a kind of Obi-Wan Kenobi of politics. I just don't understand how many times he needs to be struck down before he actually comes back more powerful. I suppose it's worth remembering that it has only been 8 months since Jeremy Corbyn became Labour leader. And in terms of politics and it being still 4 years to the next general election, you know, that's not very long. I mean, it's also worth remembering that the thing is, for Labour to step it up a level, they need to work out, as a party, what they all actually want. I mean, do they want to, as it's been suggested this week, chase the voters who've gone to UKIP? Do they want to chase the swing voters? Do they want to prove that they support the working class or the middle class or the upper class? There's a lot to say that chasing non-voters won't make a difference, sadly, so that's probably out the window. A report commissioned by the Trade Union Congress after the 2015 elections suggested that most non-voters had the same views as voters, so the outcome wouldn't really have changed much if they'd all voted. Though, I'd probably have had to stay up a lot later watching the vote count, and I would have drunk a lot more whiskey, and I guess that next day hangover with those shitty results would have been even worse and harder to handle. I mean, what the entire party need to do is be willing to get along, really, isn't it? I mean, it sounds obvious, probably like one of those statements that Sadiq Khan might make at some point in the future. But they really should just listen to all sides of their spectrum, from Blair right to Corbyn left, and maybe just try and create a manifesto that fits absolutely everyone, as impossible as that sounds. I mean, there's no one that the party membership will vote in as leader instead of Corbyn, and so if they are the Democratic Party that they say they are, they're just going to have to support whoever is leader. Or, I suppose the other option is that they could just split into several smaller parties. You know, I guess you could have Old Labour, New Labour, Red Labour, Blue Labour. You know, like a really depressing Dr. Seuss book where probably Horton can only hear himself. And that would then halve all of Labour's voters in 2020. And then, ha ha, Corbyn's detractors will say, we told you he wasn't electable. And now after we told everyone he wasn't for ages and kept putting him down, then he wasn't. Ha ha. And meanwhile, all the Corbyn supporters will say, actually, we did okay and we just hung on all in all and we'll definitely win in 2025 because I'm sure something magical will happen all by itself. And then we, as the people, will sigh as Prime Minister Boris Johnson is found simultaneously having sex with a pig while avoiding tax, but somehow distracts everyone by slipping on a banana skin. Okay, very quick one this week for the question of the week. The Eurovision Song Contest took place last weekend, and it is, as everyone always says, secretly a sort of political event, isn't it? I mean, not that secretly. I mean, in fact, the winning Ukrainian entry sang a song about 1944 and her grandfather being killed by Stalinism, and she did that as a sort of criticism of Putin. And I think there is nothing smarter than speaking out against the Russian leader in a TV show that's so camp in its content, he'll definitely never ever watch it. Good work. And then, of course, the Eurovision contest's new voting system confused absolutely everyone, making everyone suggest proportional representation would be better. And the British entry had lyrics in it like, we're in this together, and predictably the rest of Europe absolutely hated it. So very political. And I asked you lot this week on the Twitters and the Facebooks what Eurovision songs you thought would best represent the Remain and Brexit campaigns. And a few of you replied with these little gems. Okay, at Unreal McKay said, Boris certainly seems to be equating Brexit with Waterloo. At Real Neil Turner, he says, I can't decide, so it'd have to be Making Your Mind Up by Bucks Fizz. Oh, I think that's appropriate for many of the people in the UK at the moment. At Fluff Logic says, Remain has to be Better Together by Jack Johnson, and Brexit has to be Sail This Ship Alone by Beautiful South, which is, I think, probably slightly too poetic for either of those campaigns. At Daniel Woodrow, he says, Love Shine a Light into Farage's Head so we can have definite proof that it's empty, and Why Do I Always Get It Wrong for Boris? It doesn't matter if he gets it wrong, people will still like it, that's the problem. At Scott McKeating, he says, The Grey People, because I'm bored fucking shiteless of all of this. And Nuncio2 says, not sure about Brexit as a whole, but ooh, are just a little git for Michael Gove. Perfect. And now, a super, super quick.
It's the Partly Big Society.
There's a really nice petition on 38 Degrees, which, yeah, look, that may mean it might amount to nothing other than you get emails every 2 minutes about every single petition ever, about everything ever. But look, this one's a really good cause, so do check it out. This one's created by Chris Peach, and it's a campaign to install proper lighting on all major paths in Glasgow's Queen's Park. If you've ever been there, it is a great and really, really lovely park in the day, but at night time it sort of changes a little bit, as I once discovered when thinking I could shortcut to a gig, and instead I got chased by a very angry drug addict, although the energy I had on stage that night will never be matched. The petition only needs 500 signatures more to reach its target to get all the proper lighting for all the paths and make it a safer and nicer place for all the people there, and it's already got some really good backing from local councillors. So... Do head along to the 38 Degrees website. I'll also tweet it from our account and Facebook it, and search for Light Up Queen's Park and get signing. And that's all for this week. Thanks to @Budgie on Twitter for one gag. Do follow him and bug him to write more stuff. And as always, you can drop me a line too via @ParpoleBro on Twitter, ParpoleBro on Facebook, or, well, you know, whichever email you like. I mean, really, it would cheer up the empty inbox if you sent them to partlypoliticalbroadcast@gmail.com. It would feel a little bit wanted. But, you know, I can't tell you what to do. I'm not your dad. Well, at least not officially, anyway. Also, please, please, please keep the iTunes reviews coming in. I honestly don't care what they say anymore, as long as you stick a 5-star rating on them. Yes, I am that shallow. This week's show was brought to you by the number Hitler and the letters Hitler and Hitler.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.